live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems, and the people they touch.
I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And I'm Tim Lloyd.
And from St. Louis Public Radio,
this is We Live Here. In this episode, Life After Lockup.
It starts with a felony. Maybe robbing a convenience store, forging a check, or perhaps even murder. It's a major crime, and it lands someone in prison for a long time. 10 years, 20 years, maybe even life.
Yeah, but people get out of prison, and then what? Do they have support from their family? Do they end up back on the streets? What services help them get back on their feet, or do they end up back in prison?
So we have a lot of numbers about prison systems. Like in 2013, there were around 1.5 million people locked up in state or federal prisons, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. And that's not including all the people locked up in local jails for lesser crimes.
Or in this state, in 2012, while blacks only made up 12% of Missouri's population, they made up about 38% of the state's prison populations.
And since fiscal year 2004, more than half of ex-offenders released from Missouri state prisons have returned to prison within 5 years.
So you get the point. There are a lot of numbers about the prison system, and they can tell us a lot of stuff, like who's in jail, what they're there for, and if they land behind bars again. But these numbers don't tell the whole story.
Right, because prisons aren't really filled with numbers. They're filled with people, people who have their own stories to share.
So what do you say we wrap up our first run at covering the criminal justice system with just some stories from folks we've heard along the way?
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
That's coming up right after this break.
You know, the thing is, people usually tell their stories much better than we can. So what do you say we just kind of take a step back and get out of the way?
That's a deal. So with this in mind, where do you want to start?
How about with Jermaine Richmond?
Sure.
I was 19 when I made a real bad decision. But I was in a rush to grow up, always wanted to be with the older guys, you know, just fascinated by the things that they did. So at a young age, maybe like 16, I started selling drugs. And I was actually friends with a guy that was real, he was real deep off into the drug game, you know, as far as meaning like making a lot of money. And I was small time. But we was just hanging out one day riding, and before you know it, some shots rang off at the car, you know, the windows bust. We dug down, you know, it's kind of scary. Fear for our life. So after we, you know, came up and made sure when nobody hit or whatever, he actually seen the car turn in the corner. So after that happened, we still hung together. We were still buddies. I didn't, you know, disregard his friendship because that happened. Still was hanging with him. About 2-3 weeks later, we was together hanging out like we usually do. Driving out in the county, happened to see the same car that shot at us. Now he following him. So I'm not knowing really what's going to happen, but in my mind it's like something is going to happen, but it's more so going to be his situation because it's his whole deal with the guy. And before you know it, I was accessory to murder.
Jermaine was given 45 years in prison.
When you first get in shipping receiving, well, you know, where they make you change clothes and take you through all the little stuff they got to get at your information and all this. It's a sign as soon as you come in there. It says, welcome to MSP, Missouri State Prison. Leave all your hopes and dreams behind you. And that sign just stayed in my mind for years. I'm like, 19, leave all my hopes and dreams behind me? At 19, it's over with at 19? I could never really wrap my mind around that. I got to prison in 94. I didn't have a change of heart to 2001. I always felt like I was victimized by my situation. I was with a guy, I didn't pull a gun, I didn't shoot the gun. I mean, I didn't do it. I mean, I'm actually not the person that done it. And just by, I don't know how this happened, but I wind up getting, I guess they randomly select people to go to certain programs if you haven't been. I don't know, but I had to go to an ICVC, Impact on Victim Crime class. I'm still connected with them. That's a mandatory class. But I went to the class, and they teach you about the cause and effects of your action, how you affect a lot of people, the ripple effect, how the pain never goes away, how you victimize a lot of different people. And in that class, I had a real breakthrough. I mean, a lady told me, because I was be standing back, didn't really want to talk, and she got me to talk. And I told her about my whole case and the situation, and she say, you're not a victim. She said, you victimize people. She say, you allowed yourself to stay in that situation. You should have removed yourself from that situation. So you can't play the victim role. You victimize your son, your mother, your sisters, all your family, want you out there. So you victimize them. And actually that night I went, got in the shower and I cried. And from that day on, my whole life changed. I really haven't had no problems. I started thinking different. I started thinking more, I guess, mature, grown, with a better understanding, because I wasn't playing the victim role no more.
Jermaine was participating in a lot of prison programs in hopes of gaining parole, but he wasn't engaging in the classes. Eventually, he saw the benefit to what the classes were teaching.
He became active in Father Support, which helps prisoners navigate personal and professional relationships. Jermaine went on to become the president of the prison chapter of the NAACP. He eventually made parole.
I was incarcerated for 18 years, 6 months, and 26 days.
When he left jail, Jermaine wanted to take things slow and adjust. Employment wasn't the first thing on his mind.
But he found a job through Ronald L. Jones, owner of a funeral home and someone Jermaine had invited to speak with prisoners as part of the NAACP.
Jermaine knows he's lucky to have a job. Most people with a record struggle to find employment.
My first day home, my son was driving me around because I didn't have a driver's license. And we actually drove past his place of business. And I sink the business. I said, stop, let's go in there. And as soon as I went there, he offered me a job. My first day home. I said, man, it's going good. It's going good. And I've been here ever since. It's been 3 years. I never thought that I would be working at a cemetery and actually liking it. This job was a blessing to me because it put me on a straight and narrow path. You know, getting a check and not worry about where your next meal coming from or how you're going to support you or somebody else. So this job put me on a straight and narrow path. It made me stay focused on my job and my career where the pitfalls of the streets and everything else don't even call me. Now, like a lot of guys that don't have a job, can't find a job, I can see how they can fall back in that pitfall, that quick, fast money. Like Mr. Bourne say, it's a hidden price tag in that. So the job put me on, the job is a blessing.
A blessing he wishes more prisoners had access to, because he says while many don't believe it, people can change.
Prison can change you. Prison, like I said, Department of Correction. A lot of people can be corrected in there. If you think about guys that made a mistake when they were 16 and 17 and then been locked up 23, 27 years, you can't tell me that's the same person. That's not the same person. People do change, especially if they want to change. And everybody in a lost cause. I changed my life totally. I did a whole 360, and I'm standing on it. I mean, I ain't saying I'm walking this walk and then behind closed doors doing something else. I'm actually on a positive path. And what if somebody would have never, got another chance? So all that changing that I did, I have no way of proving that I'm an actual changed person. I just feel that some people do deserve another chance. Especially if they change their heart and their condition, you know, the way they think, they deserve another chance. I truly believe that.
Our next story is from Maurice Robinson. He's in his 60s and his struggles stem from a long, long battle with addiction.
To understand where he's at today, we started by asking him to describe his childhood.
I had a good childhood. I can't lie to you about that. But my parents were good parents. My dad was more like his dad, alcoholic. But he tried to do his best to make sure that we had something in our household. See, he didn't hit me with a belt. He hit me a couple times with his hand. And my mom said, "No, you can't hit him like that, honey." You know, we was young kids then. We was real young. You know, I don't think my dad really intentionally wanted to hurt me. I had some devious ways. That makes sense? I had some real devious ways when I was young. And I was wild. When I turned to alcoholic, I didn't know it until I used to go and get some whiskey bottles. This is funny. I never told nobody this. When I was young, I stayed in Kenlock. I used to go out there by the theater. Used to be out there, and we stayed next to it. And I'd pick up old whiskey bottles out there and drink out of them, you know, laying on the ground. I did. I went to school, but I didn't stay in school a lot. I wasn't a learning student as I should have been. My mother always pressed us to learn more because you're going to need it as you get education. And I made it all the way up to the 11th grade.
The early addiction to alcohol would grow more intense after another turn in his life.
As a teenager, Maurice enlisted in the Army in 1969.
Because I already had a brother in the war. He was already going to Vietnam. And so I said, if I enlist, I might not have to go, you know. So I thought I could sneak out of it. Wrong.
And what he saw in Vietnam still haunts him.
Night fights was hard when the mortar rounds come in. You never did see them. You always see a lot of fire and people howling. You get up, you may see an arm here, a head there, or any parts of the body. You have to police that up and make sure they get their body's parts home. It's hard to tell who was Johnny, who was Billy. We didn't know. We just put them in bags. Probably shouldn't be saying that, but that's just the real thing, what happened. But anyway, I got ready to come home. And I went to Germany. I like Germany. Got a chance to cook in the officer's club over there and got a chance to go to castles, Paris, and Amsterdam. So. And you know what, one thing bothered me a lot? Most everybody I met over there still drank. We still drugged. We still couldn't keep ourselves together. Like we was always talking about the war, what happened. We couldn't focus on family or getting back to the United States. We just wanted to come home, but how could we handle it? Then once you get home, some guys say they're ready to go back. I couldn't understand that. Then it happened to me. The same adrenaline flow, the same loneliness and disparity set in. And I just wanted to go back. I just wanted to do something else in my life. I couldn't take control, so I chose the street life. I chose the alcohol. I chose the drugs. And I didn't choose my family. And they was reaching out to me, "Why don't you come stay with us? Or, can you come talk to me? What's really wrong?" I couldn't tell them. What was really wrong was within me. It was because every time I induced some drugs or alcohol, I would change. And when I didn't have it, I'd be like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde syndrome. It changed me. Mm-hmm. So my mother said one day, "I just don't know who you are no more."
Maurice's addiction deepened. Drinking gave way to crack cocaine.
He became entangled in the street life. Maurice's relationship with his children became more and more distant. Finally, he's picked up for selling stolen property, a bike, microwave, and color TV, to get the cash he needed to feed his addiction.
When they hit the gavel and said, "I now sentence you to this," I said, "Lord, I just don't know if I can do this." And I looked around and see people in the audience I might know, you know, and I cried. So, yeah, it's a hurting thing. It's like your whole life just go right behind you or right before you, you know. You don't know which way it's going. Like, you don't know which way is up. The first time I went to prison, I was scared crapless. Excuse my language, but I was, if I may say so. I'm telling you because I had to go to the Missouri, the old MSP wall. And when you go through there, you say, "Welcome through the gates of hell into the house of horror. Leave all your hopes and dreams behind." I said, "Oh, my God." And there's so much stuff going on. When you walk through, like, you just smell blood, smell death, you know. I said, "I can't do this." And believe it or not, I had a tear come out of my eye, but I won't let nobody see it.
Maurice served 4 years.
And after being released, he once again tried to get back on his feet. But in 2005, after a gruesome attack by a man wielding a hatchet, Maurice found himself clinging for life. When he got out of the hospital, Maurice said his drug addiction returned with a vengeance.
To feed his addiction, Maurice wrote a bunch of bad checks and was sent back to prison for forgery and identity theft. By now, his relationship with his 8 children was painfully distant.
Every holiday, I would try to send my birthday card. I would call them on the phone because you had to have a phone card to call them out of money on your account to pay for the phone bills. And I always tell them I love them no matter what. So one year when I called them, they said, "Dad, we'd like to come see you." I said, "What?" They said, "Dad," to myself. And so my son came up first, my oldest boy, and my baby son. And you talking about a happy man to see them? And I said, "Y'all want to come see me?" And they didn't call me Maurice. You know what they called me? Daddy. I cried right there in the visiting room because I hadn't heard that word in years from any of my children. Sorry about that. From any of my boys, so. When they called me daddy, That made me feel good. I hadn't heard that in years from them. And we grabbed each other and hugged each other. They bought me some of my favorite food, and that was Chinese rice. I love pork and rice and fried rice. And sorry. And we had a great time that day. Sorry. I'll never forget that one. So ever since then, it's been daddy.
But when he was released after his second prison stint, Maurice says his family didn't believe that he had kicked his addiction.
So when I came out again, I got homeless up there, and I left him alone and started doing other things again. And what did I do? Went back to drugs, right? Not too long ago. Just not too long ago.
How long have you been clean?
I've been clean now since February 22nd. You add it up. So February 22nd, I've been totally clean.
So for the past 4 months, Maurice has been sober.
He was put in touch with Connections to Success, a nonprofit social service provider that helps ex-offenders find jobs and housing. He also started getting help from a string of other nonprofits, like the St. Patrick Center.
And on a recent afternoon, he shows us his new home.
All right, here we are, guys. Welcome to my apartment, 202. This is the Freedom House Place.
Freedom Place is a recently refurbished apartment building near the Central West End that houses homeless vets like Maurice.
He has a grandfatherly air as he shows us around his tidy little apartment.
Everything here is connected almost together. This is a two-bedroom apartment. I wasn't looking for that when I got it. Actually, I told them I don't do adjoining bedrooms. They opened the door and said, no, that's yours too. I started crying and jumping and shouting. So I was blessed to have two bedrooms, just one for Jesus and one for me. So that's how I live up here, living large.
There's on-site counseling and group meetings with other veterans.
But Maurice says even the best-designed programs won't work unless an ex-offender is ready to make a change in his or her life. Maurice will turn 64 years old at the end of this month.
He knows that sobriety can be a fragile thing. So Maurice has some pretty simple goals set for himself. And at the top of that list is repairing the relationship with his kids.
Yeah, I just don't see him enough, though. I wish I could. So we talk, though, often when I call him. You know, I always say hi and this, and you need anything. And I say, no, I'm okay. I say, you sound good. I said, well, it's just God. So, but they know I'm doing okay. They know where I'm at. But we don't get a chance to feel each other yet. Right now, I want to wait. I don't want to make sense. I guess it's not time yet.
There is one thing that prison statistics don't always show: the number of children whose parents are behind bars.
They're left without their moms or dads, and data can't describe the impact that can have on a child.
So we talked to one mom and her daughter about how prison shaped both of their lives.
Hi, my name is Patty Berger. I'm a grandmother, a mother, a substance abuse counselor, college student, and a formerly incarcerated woman.
Patty says her life with drugs started at a ninth grade picnic when someone passed her a joint.
I smoked my first joint when I was 13. I had a needle in my arm when I was 16. At 19, I came to St. Louis with a man I met and only knew him 2 weeks. We ended up being together. I have two children by him. He and I traveled. We lived in California. We lived in Georgia. And when we came back to St. Louis about a year later, he got murdered going to buy drugs. At that time, my son was 2.5, and my daughter, I was still pregnant with her. And when he died, instead of me, there wasn't an option for me to go back to Pittsburgh. My family had basically disowned me because he was of another race than I was. And so I stayed here in St. Louis. And his family, you know, they always were very open to me. And so I went very deep into my addiction, and I set my children with them. And I felt like they could offer them more than I could. I didn't have any resources. I didn't have a job. All I had was heroin.
Patty's addiction drove a wedge between her and her children, and that divide would only get wider through the years as Patty landed in and out of jail for stealing and drug-related charges. Her daughter, Darylyn Cunningham, says her mom rarely made time for her.
She came in the house, went straight to her bedroom with her friend, and they would get high. And I wouldn't see her for 2 or 3 days. And then when you see her, it's just like, where are you going? Oh, I'll be back. Going to steal to support her habit. So people would ask me, like, where's your mom? Like, why does your grandmother always come and, you know, come to events or come up to school or whatever? And I would say, look, after my dad was killed, my mom couldn't deal. She had a nervous breakdown. She lives in a whole totally different state than me. That was more easy than saying my mom's in prison and she's addicted to drugs. And because then you start playing 20 questions, and that was a game I wasn't willing to play. So even my closest friends didn't know.
Patty landed behind bars 11 times in Missouri over a 20-year period.
I was one of those people they talk about the revolving door. That was me. Remember, I had a roommate in prison, and she was doing a life sentence without parole. And she said something to me. She said, you're doing life on the installment plan.
In all of her time in jail, Patty only received drug treatment twice, and it only stuck the second time. She's been clean since the early 2000s, and once she got out, she worked to turn her life around.
I got out, like I said, and I participated in a women's group called Let's Start. And that was like my support group. And then I went to 12-step meetings, and I had a sponsor, and I even had a mentor. I did everything. If you suggested I stand on the corner at 2 o'clock and raise my right hand for 15 minutes, I stood out there and did it. I was at that point in my life. You know, I needed change, and I knew that I was either going to die in prison or I was going to die from my addiction, you know, and I wasn't willing to do that anymore. My motivator for me was my children, the relationship that I had longed for, couldn't give to them, and wanted more than anything.
But it's a relationship that wouldn't come easy. Her daughter, Darilyn, didn't trust Patty, or anyone, for that matter.
I have trust issues, and it's hard for me to let people get close to me because I feel like if you get close to me and I let you in, you could hurt me. And I'm not going to be hurt. I'm not going through that. So when I would come home and visit, I would avoid her. So I really didn't see, you know, anything. Growing up, she would say she would have her own place, but that was like staying at a hotel or maybe with a friend for a couple of nights or whatever if she wasn't staying in the same house as me. So for her, they're like, oh, she has her own place. And I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. Like, it means nothing. It holds no value. So actually moving back home and moving in with her and seeing the change, you know, she was working 3 jobs, going to school, going to meetings in between jobs or going to school, and really her being clean was important. And I saw the change, and I saw her wanting it, and she stopped hanging out with the same people, and she started, you know, she was working things that she had never did before. Because even though I was angry and I had this wall and I had trust issues, and I still wanted my mother. I didn't get her when I was a child, and I carried that, and she got clean when I was an adult, but I was willing to forgive and forget. I, you know, accept my mom where she is today, and I know that we have a lot of learning and growing to do together.
While Patty wasn't able to be a mother to her children in their youth, she's doing her best to be there for her grandchildren.
My son's married. He's got 4 children, and I'm a grandma, so I spend a lot of time trying to be the best grandmother that I can be. And for me, that's spending time with my grandkids, and it's my second chance in life to be the mother I couldn't be for my kids. And with that said, it's sometimes hard because I watch my kids see me with my grandkids, and I know that the thought is there. Wow, what if she could have been there for us? You know, and that hurts me. It brings tears to my eyes now. No. But I couldn't. I can be who I am now and move forward. So yeah, that's a very important piece of it, you know, getting that second chance.
Between 2004 and 2014, the percentage of females who were either incarcerated or supervised by Missouri's prison system was up 28%. That's 4 times the percentage increase for men.
So we wanted to know what's being done to help these ex-female offenders find their way back into the workforce. And that took us to this kitchen at the Forest Park campus of St. Louis Community College. Sophia Hamilton is one of about a dozen women in the community college's commercial kitchen.
Like that when you walk in the kitchen, I'm like so happy. I see a stove, I see this, I love to cook, I can cook. And it's like, I just feel at home, like when I walk into this kitchen, I feel really good. Like, it's like this is where I'm supposed to be at.
Sophia is part of an 8-week program run by St. Louis Community College and the nonprofit ARCHES. That's shorthand for Area Resources for Community and Human Services.
The program is tailored to help women with a criminal past find work in the food industry. After completing 8 weeks of classes, the women get help landing a job.
Unlike the other stories we've shared with you, Sophia didn't spend years in prison. She was in St. Louis City's jail for 3 months after pleading guilty to misdemeanor-level forgery and identity theft.
But like we told you last episode, even crimes that carry short sentences or no sentence at all can be a major hurdle when it comes to finding work.
This being on my record is a barrier because it's like it's forgery, it's considered stealing. So it's like people don't want me working in their job because they think I'm a thief. Or they think I'm gonna steal somebody's identity, but that's not true. So it's kind of hard for me to find a good job. Because it's like I'm not a murderer, I'm not a killer or anything, but it doesn't matter. A record is a record, and that's what people judge you by.
She says she feels like people didn't look beyond her record, and that judgment is painful. But here, in the kitchen with women who share similar experiences, she's not Sophia the criminal, she's just Sophia.
And she tells us that finding these new job skills has helped her gain a self-confidence that she didn't always have.
Because this is the, like, something that's accepting us, accepting me, I don't want to say us. It's accepting me, and it's like putting me in an environment where I love to be in, which is school. I love learning, and I'm learning something different, and it makes me feel good about myself. It makes me feel like I said, that I'm more than what I think of myself. Because I used to wear fake eyelashes and I used to wear hats on my head. And that was like my shield. But when I'm in the kitchen, we can't wear that. So it's just like, okay, I'm cooking with my hands and I don't have this hat on. Everybody looking at me, you know, and then I'm like, you know what? I'm okay. Like, and you know, it's like I'm not taking my frustration out on this knife. I'm just happy. It's a good feeling. Like, I just feel good that I don't have on these lashes. I don't have this on. That gives me, like, I got confidence in myself because I just thought I was the ugliest person in the world. That's what I've been through. But I'm not. I'm beautiful in and out. So it makes me feel good going in that kitchen. It really does.
All right. Hi, I'm Les Johnson, Vice President of Grant Management Services with ARCHES, which is Area Resources for Community and Human Services. The restaurant business is a place for second chances. You know, souls who are trying to redeem themselves and find themselves again. And it seems like that's true. I don't know if it's because of the, folks are able to find other people that are similar to themselves in that setting and find some characteristics that they can relate to. And it just naturally seems to work out that way. I'm not really sure, but it really seems to be, has worked out for us and the men and women that we've placed in those job opportunities.
This is the third year of the culinary program, and it's relatively small. It takes $90,000 to run a class of 15 trainees, or $6,000 per student.
Of the 26 female ex-offenders who graduated in 2013 and 2014, 22 were placed in jobs, and 17 are currently employed. Almost none of the women have returned to prison.
And in order to take it to scale, we've got to bring additional funding and leverage resources to the table as well. Not really an easy sale for most investors to kind of look at and say, you know, why give to an ex-offender when I can give to a person that doesn't have that label, you know, or my money goes to a child. But we see this as a way of investing on the front end to reduce recidivism rates, reduce crowding in Missouri's prisons, and also you turn what many would consider a tax taker into someone who's actually now contributing to taxes, earning a living, and not receiving any funding from the state or the federal government to support their families or themselves, and creating their own livelihood.
Which is what Sophia hopes to do someday, work in a kitchen, run her own restaurant. But right now, she's looking forward to finding more permanent housing, where she can use her new skills and cook for her children in her own kitchen.
Oh my God, it's gonna make me feel so good. Like, it's gonna make me feel good. I'm always crying. Because that makes me feel really good. And I'm able to show my children what I learned in this kitchen. It's gonna make me feel really good.
He spent the last 2 months exploring the criminal justice system. But as we've heard from the stories today, these people pass through many systems, educational, racial, economic, and social, before they ended up in prison or jail.
And we're going to continue exploring how all of these systems work together. Next on the list, health.
Families.
Doctors.
Insurance.
Environment.
Access and choices.
Next time on We Live Here, we zoom out for the big picture view of health disparities in the St. Louis region. We Live Here is produced by me, Emmanuel Berry.
And me, Tim Lloyd. Shula Newman is our editor, and Margie Fry-Vogel is the editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
Our theme music was composed by Casey Morgan.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. From PR.